Hello.
You are listening to America Unchained. Today's topic is education. It is evident that it is no longer safe to go back to school as normal. Administrators and government officials are scrambling to think of plans to properly incorporate the learning process into social distancing measures. Some schools have even opted to go fully online, while some are adopting more of a mixed approach. But anyway, the process is hashed out, it is certainly not optimal and unprecedented. There seems to be no better time than now to talk about the shortcomings, not just of this coming school year, but of the general underfulfillment of our young people's education in America today. But before getting into a general discussion of the right of education, Richard, could you outline the difficulties and maybe some of the solutions we would be best to employ in the coming months?
Well, you know, the entire nation is facing this vast challenge of how to continue education at all levels so as not to deprive a whole new generation of young people of the fulfillment of the fundamental right to education. And in the United States, as in many countries in the world that failed to contain the coronavirus soon after its outbreak, we had to close our schools at all levels. Or at least when I say close our schools, in many cases that involved not simply shutting them down, but transforming education to remote learning. And this was the route taken by most institutions of higher learning. After the spring break, they told students not to return, and instead they counted on all college and university students having access to broadband, and classes resumed through Zoom meetings and other online vehicles. In some public schools, the students were enabled to carry on with online instruction. That was true, of course, of schools that had the resources to do so and of student bodies that, by and large, had access to computers and broadband at home. But many schools were not in that situation, and they had to shut down completely. And now we're in a situation where in most of the United States, the wave of infection has not reduced. It's gaining velocity at a frightening degree. And although much of the spread is among a younger population that is itself susceptible to a much lower rate of death and serious illness, the large numbers of young people who are now coming down with the coronavirus are going to be spreading it to their parents, their grandparents, to other members of the community who are more vulnerable. So the great leap in the rates of new infections is going to, in the weeks to come, gradually be accompanied by an increasing rate of death. And that is putting the reopening of schools at all levels in the United States in a very challenging position. Now, we're talking about a risk that applies to the students themselves. It applies, of course, to the teaching core. It applies to all the staff in schools at all levels. And of course, it applies to the family members of students and staff, and by extension, to their entire communities. The CDC just came out with a report that the Trump administration attempted to keep hidden, where the CDC indicated that under conditions such as we are afflicted with, where the rate of infections is not increasing but accelerating rapidly, reopening schools is something that poses the highest risk of turning into a super spreader catastrophe. Now, one might think that this would indicate that the only route to follow would be to try to continue educating people at all levels by using remote teaching. Now, remote teaching is recognized by all, especially after the experience of last spring's and early summer's engagement in mass remote teaching as something that is not by any means ideal. You know, students long for some direct contact with teachers, as well as to having more direct contact with one another in classes at all levels. But nevertheless, it certainly is better than nothing. And remote teaching can at least prevent students from spreading coronavirus to one another and to their families, and having transmission between staff, teaching staff, and other staff as well. But there is this one problem that is faced by relying on remote teaching, especially at the pre-college level. That is, not everyone in the United States has access to broadband, let alone to the computers and broadband services that would enable them to continue learning remotely. That, of course, is a big problem for a large part of our population, that for lack of broadband and the money to pay for broadband service and to have sufficient computers and so forth, much of our population is not in a position to be able to work remotely, which puts them at risk of having to go to work where the conditions are not yet safe. And it puts their children at risk of simply not being able to carry on their education. So in other words, if conditions are such that the contagion has gotten so out of control that there's no way of safely reopening in-person instruction, then there is an imperative to have a second best solution of having education carry on at all levels remotely. But that requires that we provide broadband to everyone. We provide computers to everyone. We provide the paid services that everyone needs so they can take the second best route. Now, on the other hand, other nations, which have been much more successful than we have gone ahead and reopened schools, but they've done so in a way where they've taken some significant precautions. Germany is an example. Germany has done a much, much better job of containing the spread of the coronavirus and thereby preventing the complete economic collapse that has been followed by having to shut down large parts of our economy. What they've done in schools is, first of all, they have introduced a large degree of social distancing. Not only are students and staff wearing masks, but they are having multiple shifts so that they can reduce class size and cut it in half, if not more, and thereby enable students to be spaced sufficiently apart that the risk of transmission are significantly lowered. In addition, and I think this is a crucial measure, they are testing every student and every staff member twice a week for the coronavirus. And whoever has a positive test is going to be contact traced, and everyone exposed or everyone who has tested positive is required to go into quarantine. And in Germany, you have paid sick leave, paid family leave, so people, in a sense, can afford to go on paid leave. Now, of course, all of these situations, which would involve people going into quarantine or people going into situations where schools, on the other hand, might have to be closed or have schedules where there are multiple shifts, this is going to be putting strains on childcare. So if this is going to be feasible and people are going to try to go back to work, there has to be a provision of public childcare that is safe. Now, in the United States, as there is talk of reopening schools, many school districts are not even requiring or not yet requiring mandatory wearing of masks. They are not yet committing themselves to having distancing by drastically reducing class size by having multiple shifts. They're not talking about how we deal with transporting children to school through buses, right? How are we going to ensure that on the buses, children are sufficiently spaced apart so they're not transmitting the disease to one another? And then there's not even talk about shutting down cafeteria and other facilities in the school where students would be put in close proximity. We have to remember that in American schools, many of our students are victims of mass poverty. So they depend upon free meals in schools to have lunch, even breakfast. Because we are a nation that does not provide medical care to everyone, many, many children depend upon school nurses to provide them with some kind of regular medical care. And for many, many American children, the only place where they are going to be consistently receiving the vaccinations they need is at schools. So with the shutdown of schools or the continuation of schools with remote education, children are not being vaccinated as regularly as they need to be. And that is putting us in face of a looming second wave of contagion, of infectious diseases for which we do have vaccines, but which partly because of the mass closing of schools, a sufficient number of school vaccinations are not taking place. Now, as you know, university faculty have begun to rebel about answering the call of coming back to in-person instruction, because they realize, although students may by and large be able to avoid death and serious illness because of their age, many faculty are not in that position, as well as many family members of both faculty and students. So they're rebelling at that, the need for classes to resume with in-person teaching. And there has been no commitment in the American universities across the board for frequent testing. Now, Harvard has said that it's going to test all its incoming undergraduates once a week, and presumably all staff and faculty. And presumably that will lead to contact tracing and quarantining. And that's something that, following the German model in their public schools, is something that would need to be followed in all colleges and universities if there's going to be any possibility of containing the infection and preventing in-person instruction from becoming a super spreader catastrophe. And I think it's very important that parents, faculty, and students themselves begin mobilizing themselves to refuse to come back to school unless the proper conditions and safety conditions are met.
Piled on top of this, I think it's important to note that a lot of people who go to school, college and before, it becomes a escape from maybe not as ideal home life. A lot of people have issues that they would like to run from at a home, and that makes it even more difficult, even with broadband. And so this ties into broader discussions about ensuring that a home life is properly treated, and it's going to thereby put maybe more struggle on the social works that we already have in place for social workers and police officers and stuff like that. And also, moreover, it's we're approaching some of the worst months for the virus, which is maybe one of the more scary parts about this, that we don't know exactly how it's going to take effect in winter. And by all accounts, it seems like it's going to be worse in winter time. So people are cutting off school early.
I think it's important that you point out that when people are not able to go to school, and especially pre-college schooling, and when they're forced with the possibility of only having instruction remotely at home, the challenges they face are not just a matter of lack of broadband, but also the challenges people face at home because of lack of sufficient space to do any studying, right? And then also being susceptible to all sorts of not just distractions, but abuse on the part of siblings and parents. And schools serve, in a sense, an important role in our country in being a place where instances of abuse are recognized by teachers, by counselors, by staff, and action is then something that can be taken with the help of social workers and others. But without that experience taking place, with people stuck at home, this kind of protective service is absent. I think when we're facing this rapidly advancing deadline where schools are supposed to reopen, we have to recognize why this is so important in the lives of everyone. And I think we have to face up to the fact that education is a fundamental human right. And I think that's not really recognized by many in the United States. It's certainly not recognized by our Constitution, which offers no guarantee of education. Now, most other constitutions in the world do acknowledge that there's a right to education. And this is acknowledged internationally in Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which reads as follows. Everyone has a right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. Elementary education shall be compulsory. Technical and professional education shall be made generally available, and higher education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit. I think it's interesting to look at what is put forward in this Article 26. There is this notion that there is a right to education. It's not a privilege, it applies to all. It should be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. And moreover, these fundamental stages, these elementary stages, should be compulsory. Everyone should be required to undergo this kind of education. Now, we want to ask, what is the kind of education to which everyone is entitled and to which everyone should be compelled to undergo? And this is kind of an interesting thought because it reflects something that is fundamental to all rights, namely that rights also involve duties. And, you know, why is it that rights involve duties? Well, for the very simple reason that rights are not privileges. They involve prerogatives. They involve a range of choice to which you are entitled, but to which not just you are entitled, but everyone else is entitled, which means you have a duty to respect the opportunities of others to exercise that same prerogative, that same right. And in some respect, education plays a role in being an enabling condition for us to exercise our rights. Now, you might ask yourself, how would education play that role? Well, to exercise your rights, you have to know what their boundaries are, which is another way of saying knowing what your duties are towards others. And when we're talking about the edifice of freedom, it begins with property rights, because you can't be entitled to anything unless you are recognized to be owner of your own body and not to be a slave. But you also have to have the right to conscience, to be held accountable for what you do on purpose, not for things that you cause to happen irrespective of your intentions and purposes. You have to have the right to be able to have a family life, to be a spouse, and to, as a spouse, have rights which are going to be not privileges that a spouse of a particular gender or sexual orientation is going to have, and from which others who lack that kind of identity are going to be deprived. No, we're talking about rights to co-determine one's household, rights of parenting. We have rights in society to enter the marketplace, to defend ourselves in the courts, to exercise an occupation of our choosing, to have equal economic opportunity. We also have rights in the political sphere. In all cases, we have to know what the boundaries of these rights are and what our respective duties are and what is involved in being able to wield these rights. And that requires also, obviously, knowledge of how to communicate with the fellow members of one's community, which may require knowledge of more than one language, depending upon the linguistic character of the community to which one belongs. It's also going to require a knowledge of reading and writing and arithmetic to have the kind of basic literacy that allows one to then acquire an understanding of nature, of the human psyche, of history, of the workings of an economy, of the workings of a society, the working of politics. I mean, all of these things, and I should also mention the workings of the family, and what indeed are one's rights as a parent and as a spouse. I mean, all these things you have to know to be able to exercise your freedoms and to respect the freedoms of others. So all of these matters, which could be said to be an education for freedom, are matters that everyone needs to be able to undergo, and also matters to which everyone must be required to undergo and to obtain these kind of knowledge and skills. Now, in addition to that, if we are going to be able to exercise a livelihood, we have to have more than a common education. We have to have access to what Article 26 speaks of as technical and professional education, namely, broadly speaking, vocational education. Education will allow us to be able to have a decent livelihood on a par with others. And that can also, of course, involve types of specialization that require retraining as markets change, as technologies change, and so forth. And higher education might be thought of as part of that, to the extent that higher education could be looked at being oriented towards very specific kinds of occupations in universities themselves, occupations in research, occupations in fields that require advanced degrees that could involve medicine, psychiatry, etc., economics and the like. Well, you can see how, if one is to exercise equal opportunity in society, one is going to need both this common education for freedom and access to what could be considered a specialized technical or vocational kind of education. Now, we can ask ourselves, how is this right going to be fulfilled? And as you know, in the United States, schooling at all levels is available privately. That is to say, there are enterprises, both for-profit and non-profit, that are offering education in schools, in elementary schools, in secondary schools, in colleges and universities, that are not public institutions, but private. And of course, you have to pay. They have to survive. They have to be able to fund themselves. So this raises the question, can one rely on private education to fulfill the right to education? And the same question, in a way comes up with regard to the fulfillment of many other rights. Can one rely on an exclusively private system of healthcare to ensure the fulfillment of the right to healthcare? Can one rely on a purely private offering of legal resources, to be able to be sure of being able to fulfill one's right to legal representation? Now, clearly, if you have to pay for your education, this can present challenges to people when you have inequality in income and wealth, right? And if you rely on private education and you have a society in which inevitably the workings of the market are going to lead to inequalities in wealth and income, then there is not going to be an even playing field regarding access to education if it relies exclusively on private education and the workings of the marketplace. Now, if one wants private education to be broadly accessible, as it has to be, if it's going to be something that will be fulfillable as a right, then one could try to overcome the shortcomings in income and wealth that will prevent families to be able to send their children to private education. And, you can think of various schemes to do so, voucher systems and the like, and of course, scholarships. Theoretically, you could think of a way in which supplements to income and wealth and such things as just free scholarships based on need could be employed to ensure that access to private schools would be something that could be generally available. But there is one limitation to any such plan, and that is there's no guarantee that there are enough private schools at any level to ensure that everyone receives the education they need. So even if one were to rely on a private system and then supplement it with the requirement that all children be admitted and their families be provided with any whatever supplementary income is needed or scholarship aid is needed, there's still the problem of having a proper supply. And then there's another side to the issue of education that I think we have to think about, and we'll speak about this. It really comes up in a way later. And that is the way in which the differing conditions of income and wealth of different families, as well as different groups of the population, impose disadvantage on children that are going to affect the contribution that school will provide to their education. In other words, they're going to have their hands tied behind their back by circumstances that apply to the economic deprivation of their families. And that can involve a deprivation in a society like ours, where access to healthcare depends upon how much money you have. It can involve deprivations with regard to physical, dental, and medical, and mental healthcare, which can have crippling effects on the development of the young person and their ability to take advantage of educational opportunities. Of course, needless to say, the lack of decent education of one's parents and family members can also obviously limit what kind of assistance one gets at home. And then, of course, the impoverishment of homes, the lack of sufficient space, the lack of broadband, of course, the lack of a healthy dwelling can all hinder the ability of children to be able to perform academically. And that, needless to say, the very character of their neighborhoods and the extent to which all sorts of pathologies are running amok because of the deprivation of the people who live them, all can contribute to tremendous gaps of achievement, even when access to schooling is provided in a otherwise fair-handed manner. Well, I think you can see that a purely private solution to the fulfillment of the right to education is not adequate. And in the United States, although we do not prohibit private schools, we do have a system of public schools, which in principle are supposed to provide education to any child who asks for admittance. Now, there is no constitutional right in our Constitution to education. So when we talk about the right to public education, we're talking about something that has been provided for by our individual states, or what would be called provinces in other nations. Some state constitutions do give a right to education, others do not. But the fact that we leave it to the states to really provide for the fulfillment of public education has led to a situation where there are all sorts of disparities between states and within states of the amount of public resources that are available to children. Now, the differences are to be found, for example, in states having different lengths of mandatory schooling. It's also going to be found in very differing levels of support. And one of the reasons for that is that support for public education in the United States depends by more than 90% on funding that states generate. The federal government provides less than 10% of funding for education. And in most states, more than half of the funding for public education is drawn from property taxes. And needless to say, the amount of property taxes depends upon the estimated value of property. And that immediately tells you that there will be differences in revenues for education depending upon the value of real estate in the districts that make use of property taxes to fund education. And we all know that this means that given the great degree of wealth inequality in America, that there are going to be great differences in support for education, public education, so long as it derives from property taxation. Now you see that as differences between states. You also see it as differences within states. Now, in many respects, the differences within states reflect the same kind of, the differences between states reflect the same kind of differences that you find within states with regard to concentrations of real estate value. And I think we all know that there has been a tremendous move of suburbanization in the United States, which has left inner cities more and more deprived of individuals who have the money to purchase states, purchase private houses. And we have concentrations of poverty in cities where all of this, obviously, as we all know, has taken on a racial character owing to various racially discriminatory practices regarding FHA loans, veterans loans, redlining, and other things, which have prevented African-Americans and other people of color from being able to take advantage of opportunities to make it to the suburbs. But as a result, we have cities themselves becoming more and more impoverished, having a declining tax base, suburbs becoming more affluent. And that means there's a great divide in terms of the revenues available to schools in these different regions, which also takes on a racial aspect. And needless to say, this can be reflected in the character of different states. Now, in states themselves, there is a tremendous variation in school funding. We find this, first of all, in an expenditure that makes up half of the public expenditure in education, which are teacher salaries. And in Michigan, which is at the top of the heap in terms of public spending on teacher salaries, the average teacher salary is $71,773. In Hawaii, which is the bottom of the ranking as adjusted for cost of living, the average teacher salary is $40,246. If we look at the expenditures per student, you know, we see an equally extreme divide. New York State, which comes first in expenditures per student, spends $22,366 per student. Utah, which is at the bottom of the heap, spends just $6,953 per student. Then, of course, we have the great divides within states because of this factor of school funding depending in large part on real estate revenues. And real estate revenues, by the way, are based on real estate taxes, which are generally quite regressive. There isn't any graduated real estate taxation. But nonetheless, we find that in a state like Connecticut, which does happen to spend more per student than most other states, nonetheless, there is a huge divide in resources between a city like Bridgeport, which is a tough working class town city with now a very high Latino population. Its children receive $6,000 per student less than in a fairly close by, well-to-do, upper-middle-class suburban town of Greenwich, which is a breadroom community for commuters who generally head down to Manhattan. And then you have disparities within school districts as well. Now, these all present grave challenges. You know, the whole impetus of public education is to provide a fulfillment of the right to education and overcome the disparities of opportunity that private education presents.
One disparity that I know I experienced, I went to an inner city school in Atlanta, and one of the ways that the administration was able to segregate children based off of income became through came through an honor system. Now, this is sort of a problem because at the same time you want to say that a certain level of merit will achieve a certain level of placement in these classes. But it became very apparent by the time I was in high school that the IB program, the International Baccalaureate program that I went to, was where the basically the most white kids were able to get into the IB program, while the rest were not able to get into the IB program, yeah, despite actually being a predominantly black school. My school was, I think, around 65 to 70% black, yet the IB program, there was a tokenization of that number. I mean, it was nowhere near representative of the school. And you could say a lot of this is built off of, or at least this is the argument that I've heard, is of a historical inequity of education, that their parents weren't able to get educated, so they weren't able to impart a certain amount of education on their children. And I think if that's the case, it's even more rampant in during COVID, because all those problems at home, once again, are going to bubble up even further if the day is shortened or if you're forced to study at home and et cetera. And add that there's also that within schools, segregation aspect.
Now, I think there are two important aspects of this. One has to do with what happens within schools, within the school, to children, and what happens outside the school. Now, what I'm talking about outside the school is that given the great inequalities of income and wealth that afflict our society, and the way all of these both reflect and perpetuate racial gaps in income and wealth, you have a situation where a certain group of students who come from more affluent families are being sent by their parents to all sorts of extracurricular activities that cost money. Private music lessons, private dance lessons, private gymnastic lessons, all sorts of sport things, lessons in swimming, lessons in tennis, going to soccer teams, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas kids from families that don't have that extra income, let alone the time to be shuttling kids all over the place, they have no such opportunities. And the schools do not provide those opportunities during the school day. And increasingly in our schools, teaching of music, of playing instruments, of having bands and orchestras, of having even dance being taught, of having art classes, of even having phys ed on a regular basis, are being more and more restricted because of the refusal to increase the taxes that will allow schools to be properly funded. The more affluent parents and their children can make up for these shortfalls. But those who cannot have to rely entirely on what happens in the schools, and the schools become more and more deprived. Now there are several sides to this. On the one hand, we have students in our public schools in which often we have a kind of residential segregation that carries over into the schools. And that carries over also into a segregation of support, because the more oppressed, more economically disadvantaged communities, people of color in particular, find themselves crowded into localities of lower value housing in school districts that have less funding, and their schools are going to be predominantly filled with people who are trapped within those borders. And they're getting an underfunded education that is only going to exacerbate their economic opportunities. And what is happening in many school districts is that poorer students, particularly students of color, who are hobbled at home by the deprivations of their families, which include deprivations of healthcare, both physical and mental, deprivations of having access to all sorts of things that can help them broaden their education, they're struggling to become literate. And very quickly, large numbers of such students are falling behind grade level. And if by third grade, they do not come up to grade level, and achieve a basic knowledge of reading and writing and arithmetic, the rest of their school experience is going to be a torture. It's going to be a series of humiliations because they're not going to be able to deal with the material that is thrown at them under the assumption that they can read and write and have a mathematical ability to deal with the sciences and social sciences, etc., that is being embraced to them. Now, as a result, schools find themselves with groups of students of extremely different levels of achievement because of our failures to remedy these differences in wealth and income and all of the advantages that go together with levels of wealth and income. And so schools are faced with either separating students out into different tracks, where those who are struggling are being taught at a level that might appear to be something that will be manageable, and those who are so-called more advanced are able to accelerate beyond them. Well, the other alternative is to put everyone together. But you can see the difficulties of putting everyone together if one doesn't give extra care to those who are struggling. Now, I actually was the editor of my high school newspaper. I ended up moving from Queens, New York, going to the public schools there, to a public suburban school, which had predominantly middle-class kids, almost all of whom would go to college. But there was a group of students who were more working class and would not. And we had tracking. We had tracking for the college-bound students, and we had tracking for the so-called vocationally-oriented students. And I wrote editorials criticizing this. And I got into trouble with the principal, who called me down. But whatever, the editorials went through. But that is a perennial problem that schools face. And it is not an easy problem to face simply at the level of the school. Because so long as we permit there to be mass poverty, mass deprivation in health care and mental care and counseling, a failure to balance work and family, so that parents who are working not just one job but two jobs are offered paid leave so they can come to school meetings, right? That obviously is not the case in the United States. It's very difficult for the schools on their own to make up for these deficits of opportunity. And as you remarked, you do have these divisions between so-called advanced classes, AP classes, so-called spectrum classes in elementary school, which generally are all filled with students who have all the advantages being poured upon them because they come from families where their parents themselves have higher education, are earning a decent living, can give them all sorts of private opportunities outside the class school day, whereas the other students are suffering from all the deprivations of poverty at home, have parents who don't have the time to take off from work to help them after school or to come to school meetings, and who are struggling. Now, we want to ask, how are the public schools to deal with this? Well, clearly we do need to wipe out poverty and unemployment and wipe out all of these racial gaps in wealth and income and the social rights agenda that starts with a federal job guarantee and has a fair minimum wage starting at $20 an hour that keeps pace with increasing productivity to stop the increase in income inequality. I mean, these are parts of solving the background deprivations that really put chains on students coming from more modest backgrounds. But one has to deal with this problem of unequal resources among schools and within schools. Now, in a way, you know, I think the approach we take to public schools is a correct one that needs to be applied to other kinds of public opportunities, in that when you go to public school, it's free for everyone. There are no means tests. And if you have mean tests, then there's something demeaning about it. We do have a mean test with regard to part of school services. I don't know if you know what I'm getting at. I'm talking about school lunches, right? And you have certain students who get subsidies for school lunches. I mean, school lunches should be free to everyone. No one should have to be in a demeaning situation where they're getting free lunches because their family can't pay for it, right? Everything should be available to everyone. And, you know, some school systems elsewhere in the world take the attitude that in order to really promote the equality of students in the school, in the classroom, we should have school uniforms. And the idea between that is that obviously anyone with any brains can immediately identify the affluence, the relative affluence of a student's family by what they're wearing, by and large. So the idea of school uniforms is in a sense, to have a veil of ignorance cast upon the student body. And of course, that should be applying to everything else. You know, there are certain fees that have crept into our public schools. You often have to pay for rentals for instruments in school bands or orchestras. There shouldn't be any such rentals. All of this should be available to all students. But then we have to overcome the differences in funding. And something that has been a real obstacle to doing this is the 10th Amendment of our Constitution. And that 10th Amendment to the Constitution basically reserves to states any powers that are not expressly delegated to the federal government. And this has been used by the Supreme Court in, for example, the 1973 decision of San Antonio's Independent School District versus Rodriguez. The Supreme Court invoked the 10th Amendment to rule that the federal government could not enforce any measures to have equal funding for education for all students, but had to leave the issue of funding to the states. Now, the federal government has attempted, nonetheless, to try to even the playing field. There's a 1965 Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which has allocated extra federal funding to poorer school districts. In 1990, the New Jersey Supreme Court, for example, ruled in Abbott versus Burke to require not just an equal amount of funding per student, but more funding per student to be given to poorer districts. And this, by the way, has been the approach taken by Holland on a national level, that funding for students should be such that students coming from more underprivileged backgrounds should get more funding to help make up for the deficits they face. Now, I think we need to take a similar approach. We need to really level the playing field in funding for schools. And we really need federal funding. And now we're in an emergency situation where the only way schools can reopen and have the kind of double shifts, have the kind of weekly COVID testing and contact tracing and quarantining, and be able to be in any way safe and also provide the remote learning for those who can only safely study under current conditions at home by providing them with everything they need to do remote learning with broadband and computers and everything else. Well, we need national funding of education. And it should have this kind of student-weighted formula that we give extra funding to the students who are struggling. Now, this is something that really needs to be implemented as soon as possible and made a permanent measure. And also, there are two other sides to it. One has to do with what are the kind of school expenditures that are really going to make a difference? Now, the two expenditures that have been shown by studies to be the only things that really matter are not all this technological paraphernalia of, you know, smart blackboards and the like, or even computers. It's rather teacher salaries and class size. Now, there is what has been called a teacher pay penalty. And what that means is that in the United States, the pay of public school teachers is significantly less than what individuals with comparable education will get in other fields. Now, that reflects the fact that teaching has been a field that was historically one of the few that was available to women. And today, still, 3/4 of teachers are women. And it, like other fields that are predominantly staffed by women, has lower salaries than others. And you see that in the pay penalty for male teachers is much higher than that for women, because, you know, males still have much wider opportunities in other occupations. So when they go to teaching, they're making significantly less than they could get with the comparable education elsewhere. Well, we've got to remove that pay penalty. We have to raise the teaching salaries and qualifications of teachers. What makes that really so important is it really reflects the role of teachers, because despite certain contrary views that want to look upon education as being fundamentally democratic in character, the educational situation is not something that is democratic. In other words, you do not have the equality between participants in schools that you have between participants in a democratic body politic, where we all have an equal say. Rather, the basis of the educational system or situation is that teachers have a knowledge and expertise that students do not have. And indeed, students are wasting their time if they do not acknowledge the fact that the teacher knows something they don't know and has the ability to teach it. And if the teacher, of course, does not, then they're all wasting their time. Now, unfortunately, our whole educational system for teachers does not emphasize this aspect of expertise in the subject matter that is the basis of the authority of a teacher. Instead, in order to get a teaching certificate to be able to teach in the public schools, you need to be educated in education in general, as if there were some formal technique to teaching. Formal in the sense it has nothing to do with the content of what you're teaching. So that to qualify as a teacher, you have to study education classes, not study above all the field and body of knowledge that you're going to be teaching. Now, by contrast, if you're a college professor, as I am, you never have to study any formal technique to teaching. Instead, the only thing that provides a basis of qualification is your advanced degree in the field that you're going to be teaching. So I have to have my PhD in philosophy to be able to teach. And that is the basis of my authority, whereby I can tell my students, I am going to decide what the curriculum of this class will be. I am going to decide what the assignments will be, and I'm going to decide how they're going to be graded. This is not going to be up for a majority vote on the part of you. And I think if we acknowledge this obvious point, we have to recognize that when we're dealing with schools, teachers have to have a special authority in determining how they operate. And they have to play a leading role. What is one of the most shocking things about how school districts operate in this country is that in Athens-Clarke County, we have a school board, which is in a way in control of the operations of schools. You are not allowed to be a member of the school board if you are a school employee. Teachers are completely excluded from participating in this vital part of the administration of the school system. Now here I'm talking about the public schools. Obviously, it's a vital part of our education for freedom. But we also need to turn to higher education.
One of the questions that I had about this particular argument, you're talking about education not being democratic in itself, but then again, being educated, as you said, is, or similar to what you said, is the thing that provides you the ability to know what your rights are, and knowing what your rights are as an adult allow you to enjoy them and be a member and hopefully high functioning member of civil society in general. There's an alternative approach that has been taken up in recent years that has to do with the totally radically different model. This interests me. It's the Sudbury model, where it's a democratic schooling, where there's a sort of self-teaching. The students actually tout out some of the best results in college, and also those who don't go to college, they find that they learned exactly what they needed to learn. And that seems to be the model of the Sudbury in general, learning what that person chooses to learn through life. Yep. And this seems like in some ways it could be a generally better way to teach people how to participate in direct democracy, which is one of our biggest problems today of participating in democracy. People don't do it. We have low voter turnout, and teaching people how to do that from a young age could be a good thing. So those are kind of the general arguments that are made for a possible democratic schooling.
I mean, you have the Somerville model, which is connected to this, as you know.
Right.
And the idea, in a way, is to allow students to be completely self-directed, or also alternately to think of education in terms of play. Now, obviously, self-direction has to have a role to play. One has to be able to take independent initiatives. But on the other hand, one has to recognize that there is this fundamental difference in knowledge that is the basis of the educational experience. That there are these sources of knowledge, the teacher, as well as books and other materials, and their authority has to be recognized as something that is worth making use of and worth taking advantage of. And indeed, one has to take initiatives and guide oneself, but it has to be under a higher guidance, which is going to be, let's say, informed by a recognition on the part of the student that they need teachers. They need to access those who know, that they're not in a position to reinvent the wheel at all levels. And this, by the way, reflects also, I think, the limitations of homeschooling.
Right.
And I think, as you know, homeschooling in many respects is taken up by parents who want to take their students out of public schools because they want to keep their kids away from a student body that they consider to be threatening in one way or another. Or to also keep their children away from an intellectual environment that does not fulfill certain restrictions that they want to keep their students confined to. And so parents take on the burden of educating their kids at home. Now, I think it's problematic to have parents be teaching children in an exclusive way. And that's really because of the great magnitude of what's involved in obtaining the education one needs to be a free citizen, because one has to really become knowledgeable of a great variety of fields. And to do that, you need to be schooled by people who have expertise in these fields. And no parent is going to have the expertise in all these fields, let alone the time to acquire that expertise. And I think for that reason, it's not something that we should be in any way promoting. Obviously, there are students who can manage to get by with this, particularly if they come from affluent households, which provide them with a steady stream of all sorts of stimulations and accesses to books and other things and private lessons and the like. But I think one has to recognize the difficulty of teaching, the degree to which it rests upon very specialized types of learning. And, you know, our willingness to tolerate homeschooling reflects our willingness to tolerate a system for schooling teachers that turns education for becoming a teacher into a formal exercise of studying education, not becoming highly qualified in the field of specialty. And other educational systems take a different approach. They do emphasize getting advanced degrees in the area that you're going to be teaching. Now, I think we have to recognize that there are these problems relating the fulfillment of the right to education at the level of schooling, and how ultimately we have to rely on public schools and ensure that everyone has access to a public school that's going to provide everything a student needs, as well as everything that can be provided to make up for deficits at home that are going to be handicapping the progress of students. And that includes also having, obviously, adequate counseling, adequate medical services if as needed, especially in a raw society as our own, which does not provide adequate medical care to everyone, and medical, including mental health. But similar things apply to higher education, and that higher education involves both post-secondary technical vocational schooling and our mixed variety of higher education. Because, you know, the United States has a very different kind of college system than other nations. Other nations, when you get out of secondary schools, you immediately specialize. You go directly to law school or medical school or to studying a particular subject matter. Here we have the so-called liberal arts tradition, where you're going to major in a subject matter. That will take up about a quarter of your coursework. Three quarters of your coursework will be in a kind of general education. Well, that general education is still part of what could be considered that common education to be a free individual. That specialization in the major might be regarded as a version of that kind of vocational training that one needs to be able to have any kind of equal opportunity in society. Now, if one regards our system of higher education in those terms, one can look upon it as something to which everyone should have access as a matter of right. One might even consider it to be something to which one should be required to study, perhaps. But if you're going to have access to it, we have to deal with the fact that we have in our nation both private colleges and universities and public colleges and universities. And unlike other nations, our public colleges and universities have tuition fees and other fees that in a sense present tremendous walls of access, given that we are a society in which poverty is tolerated on a mass scale, in which inequality of wealth and income is rampant. So we have that challenge, and to meet it, one way is to provide people with loans. But we know that there are 40 million Americans who are, in a sense, drowning under a gigantic student loan debt, which is now, I think, about $1.4 trillion. It's the second largest personal debt, and it's burying the life opportunities of people. So I think we have to think about canceling it. And canceling it is very much a possibility. Studies have been done by the Levy Institute at Bard College to show that we can cancel that debt, and it will actually lead to a significant growth of our GDP of between $86 and $108 billion each year, and will add between 1.2 and 1.5 million jobs annually, with negligible effect on inflation and interest rates. So if we really want to apply equal access to post-secondary school education, first we've got to get rid of the burden of student debt, and then we have to open the doors of these schools. And we all know that Bernie Sanders has put that very much on the political agenda by calling for free tuition at all public institutions of post-secondary learning. Now, I think that is something we need to take up, but it's not good enough. Because as anyone knows who has attempted to go to college, free tuition covers only part of your expenses as a student. You still need to live and meet your living expenses if you're going to be a full-time student. And in most European countries, not only is higher education more or less tuition-free, but every student gets a stipend that covers their costs of living. And if we're really going to provide access to higher education, we need to do that. We have to make higher education both tuition-free and provided with a stipend. And many years ago, I had my rare success in getting an op-ed piece published. It was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And I was criticizing the Hope Scholarship, you know, which many people were lauded, and I got tremendous amounts of negative feedback from angry readers. But I was arguing that the Hope Scholarship, as admirable as it might have seemed in trying to provide free tuition to a certain part of Georgia students, was not doing it in a proper way. First of all, it was basing its fund, its scholarship, on a lottery. And if any of you have paid attention to who buys lottery tickets the next time you're in a convenience store, it's poor people. And in Georgia, disproportionately African-American and other people of color. And that means that they're the ones subsidizing higher education for students who are going to be disproportionately not people of color. Because people of color are not going to be making it into college at the same rate as others. So here we have the poor subsidizing the higher education of the well-to-do. And in addition, we're only giving it to people who've had a B average in high school and maintain a B average in college. Well, we should provide access to higher education for anyone who doesn't flunk out. And at UGA, what has happened as a result of this requirement that you lose your Hope Scholarship if you get below a B average, students are dropping out of courses at a much increased rate, extending the years they spend in college because they're frightened of losing their Hope Scholarship. So forget lottery-funded scholarships. Let's make higher education in public branches of our university system tuition-free plus stipends. And then we could be in a position to be able to say that we are fulfilling Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because we are making access to higher education something available to all. And that is something that we need, not only if we're going to be able to wield our rights and duties as citizens of a democracy, but also to be able to exercise our equal opportunity in civil society. And as we face the coronavirus emergency, the economic collapse that our leaders' mismanagement of the pandemic has created, it's more urgent than ever to ensure that we all have access to the education we need and do not allow blockages to educational opportunity further impoverish, further disadvantage our young generation. This is something that needs to be done ASAP, and the emergency measures we take to cut down in class size, to increase teaching staff, to improve the pay of teachers and staff in general, is something that need to be made as permanent fixtures of a just system of education.
And we can invest in our future, the future of our workers and our population. Yeah. Thank you so much. I think we've gone over time, but definitely necessary. And I look forward to next week. Thank you.
Okay, great. And let's see what happens in the few weeks to come, where we are really facing a moment of reckoning regarding the future of education in this country.